Welcome to episode 16 of the ReWrap Podcast, where we talk all things about the photo, video, and creative lifestyle. Opposite me is the viral filmmaker, cinematographer, dynamo, that is the Jaron Schneider. And I am portrait and headshot photographer, Karaminder Gooman.
Wow, that is a powerful opening statement from Karaminder. It's just lots of,
We got lots to talk about this week. This week, actually, exciting week. Yeah. As most weeks, we are trying to literally squeeze the internet out of its juicy news, and it's often come a bit dry. And then we just have to like be extra creative on finding content. But I think this week, we were kicking stories out the door. Like, no, not good enough.
Yeah, there's
not
a lot to go over. Audience. And we, for the first time ever, also near the end of this, the last thing we're going to talk about is actually a question from a listener. So I'm happy about
listener
that.
Question. Listener
so. Question. Get us started. Let's go.
Let's get us started with Metabones. They rolled out with a brand new speed booster. Another one. This one's called the XL. And it's for the Canon EF and Nikon F mount, I think, for Micro Four Thirds. And so the reason why we're even talking about this is because I think this is like the third generation speed booster for... Actually, Jaron?
I think it's
what
like...
What the hell is a speed booster?
I use a Metabone Speed Booster version S, which is the second generation of their specific ones for like, it's not specifically for the Panasonic GH4. It's made for all like similar like that'll do like Olympus too. But what it does is it gives me a wider field of view. So it makes it, the crop factor is closer to like very close to APS-C. I think it's just a little bit more than APS-C. The crop comes in a bit more, but it also gives me...
Well, what does APS-C mean? You're using all this
lingo. We'll get to that because we have to talk about APS-C and APS-H and all that stuff when we talk about exactly what the XL does. But APS-C is basically the Canon 7D or like the Rebel series. So that's what an APS-C is. And full frame is, you know, 5D Mark III. But what the speed booster does that I really like, the speed boosting part, is it opens up gives me an extra stop of light. So my Sigma 35mm f1.4 becomes the Sigma 35mm f1.2. And that's awesome for filmmaking. And it's great for anyone who uses these Micro Four Thirds cameras. It also means that if you invested early in a different camera system, like I did, I invested early in Canon, and I switched my body to Panasonic, I don't have to go out and buy a whole bunch of new lenses. It's just very quick and dirty to move over. I can just use all my old optics.
That's quite cool. I think the big news about this is that when you do record 4K on your GH4, Jaron, that the image gets slightly cropped in when you're in, because it uses the actual like mapped out like pixel for pixel on the sensor to make a 4K video image. Now, when you do that with this new Metabone speed booster, it gives you the same field of view, same crop as $100,000 Arri Alexa camera that Hollywood uses to film everything that they do.
And the FS700 II from Sony, which is their camera that'll do mega slow-mo. So to be clear here, this
crop is called a Super 35, right, Jaron?
Yeah. So the difference here is the version that I have is not quite the same field of view as what they're doing with the Speed Booster XL. Speed Booster XL is better. It's a slightly wider field of view that makes it more like what actual filmmakers are using to make most of the movies we're out to. I think Red is even Super 35.
Yep, so, all Red is Super 35. Everything done in Hollywood is Super 35. The only difference or the only exception to this is IMAX cameras, which are equivalent to what we call 70mm like aspect ratio, which is huge. It's huge. It's insane.
So what this essentially does is it gives anyone who uses a Micro Four Thirds camera the ability to get the same quote-unquote look as these larger, more expensive cameras with Super 35 sensors. And that look is completely determined by the optics. The quote-unquote look is not going to do anything with the way that the sensor actually displays things. I think Red still is kind of king of that hill in terms of how it, like the colors and the way that it takes in the world and the dynamic range of that sort of thing. I'm still limited when I'm using my GH4, but at least I can get the optical look.
Yeah, and those cameras are shooting raw, and they have huge productions behind them. So this is more like not to be disrespectful, it's more like the Fisher-Price version, but this Fisher-Price version is so advanced to be able to do this. But essentially what it means is what? A $1,700, $1,800 camera, a $600 adapter. I think the adapter is about $600. And then whatever lens you kind of throw onto it, now you can achieve a very, very close, if not exactly like cinema Well, the dream book.
The GH4 is reading. Like 1800s. I would say, you say 800
or 1800? Okay, 1800. Okay, good. And then the adapters.
Right, 660, something like that. But so, like, so APS-C and APS-H. So APS-C is 1.6 crop factor and APS-H is 1.3. And the reason I bring up APS-H is because if you shoot in 1080 with this Metabone Speed Booster XL on the GH4, you'll get APS-H. Which
is pretty damn close to full frame.
It's Jeremy. Really
it's
close. It's
1.3 crop. It's very close.
So you're almost getting 1-to-1, which is, whoa, for me. Like, that's a big deal. Because I think if I want to shoot in, like, true 18 or 24 millimeter, I'm going to basically get that. It's going to be almost indistinguishably different. Almost.
Yes.
Almost.
Yes. Yeah. So. And like, I'm just trying to give people a bit of a history as to why a Super 35 is kind of relevant. Like, why don't people or those film cameras like Arri Alexa shoot on, let's say, a full frame 35 millimeter camera? And I guess the reason why is because, you know, like when you shoot film on a regular photographic camera, the film advances from either left to right or right to left, right? Basically, the film is laid out horizontally. Mm-hmm. Well, film in video cameras, before there was still cameras, shot film vertically, which means that you had a maximum width, and then you had the little sprockets on the side. Sprocket holes is usually mm-hmm. how it contains. So this meant that if you were shooting what they call Super 35, is you're limited to a maximum width. But for height, you know, you can shoot 4x3, which is what our old televisions used to be before HD, and you can shoot 16x9, which is what our current HD TVs are, and you can shoot anamorphic, which is like cinema wide. And when you shoot anamorphic, because you're using less height on film, you can squeeze more minutes of film on film. You can squeeze more minutes of footage on film. And that's kind of how actually the Leica was the first to, Oscar Barnack, who founded Leica, he was working at this German optics company. And what he did is he took that film stock, turned it sideways so that it went from vertical to horizontal, put it around a spool, and made a still camera out of that. And that's the very first camera ever made, was the UR Leica, which is, it's hard to tell. I got one on my keychain. It's kind of out of focus, but that's kind of what it looked like. It's called a UR, your Leica.
You can look that up on Wikipedia. You'll get a picture of it pretty quick. Yeah. I always pronounce it It's your, UR.
It's a UR. I could be UR. I have no idea.
I don't know.
It's German.
It just sounded German. When I say it sounds Leica. Like Uber, like UR.
A Leica.
Yeah.
That's how you say in German.
But that's kind of a reason why this matters, basically, that history all the way to where we're going now is just kind of giving more people access to this same look. That's awesome, and I like that.
That is a theme, Jaren.
Yeah.
Giving more people access. Pay attention. It'll come back in the future part of the show.
Yeah.
All right, next.
So that's cool. So this is, I found to be quite interesting. So last week, Sony put out a press release that had some information from the NPD group. And the NPD group is a company that just does market research on a number of industries. It's like their only thing they do.
Does NPD stand for anything?
Probably. What it stands for, I don't know. I just made sure that they weren't a company owned by Sony when I heard this, but they are independent. So they did. They do this regularly. Each year they do an analysis of what's going on in the industry. And one of the things they found in the camera market over the last year is that overall mirrorless camera revenue has increased by 16.5%. Now in this mirrorless division, they count everything except, like, I don't think they count point and shoots. It has to be interchangeable lens mirrorless, I believe, specifically they're looking at. No cell phones, that sort of thing. So just interchangeable lens mirrorless, ILC, was up 16.5%. And conversely, DSLR sales declined 15% again. There hasn't been a year of incline on the DSLR market in something since, like, you know, the 5D1 came out or 5D2 came out. So mirrorless is, like, really, really dominating. And Sony, so this is interesting because I need to go take a look at Sony's full year, but they haven't had a fully comfortable, they haven't had a full year from every segment of their company overall, making them a profitable business. They haven't been profitable in a really long time. Almost everything else has been dragging them down, but they've been leaning heavily on their camera market. And a couple years ago, I scoffed at them for this because their camera markets a couple years ago, their cameras were awful. I hated every camera that they came out with. And this was like maybe three.
The Alpha 99, the Alpha 7000.
The only thing for me that changed it was the Alpha full frame series. That really was the turning point. Like, the Alpha 99, was that their DSLR? Or the DSLR-looking one?
Yeah, but you're talking about full frame series. You're talking about A7 series.
Exactly. The Alpha 99, I don't think was full frame. I think that was APS-C. I don't think they made a full frame DSLR.
I'll look it up.
Please do, because I'm almost sure they didn't. So when I'm talking about their full out mirrorless A7, A7R, A7II.
Alpha 99 is full frame.
It is? Okay, so I was wrong. I'm sorry.
They make one full frame body.
They just had a really hard time taking off. And I think it's because they were trying to compete with the other DSLRs. And when they decided to stop doing that, then they made a difference. So they saw a 66% boost year over year in their mirrorless sales for a company that already had quite a bit of the market share. Like, they were already way ahead.
Samsung 66% is huge.
Yeah,
huge.
Boost over the previous year where they were already number one, way over Samsung. So Samsung is now probably way behind in terms of like that market, because they were always the number two. They passed, I think, Olympus for number two a little while ago, the last time I checked. But what this really means is that mirrorless is... it's kind of hard to avoid that as the future, and it's kind of, when you think about it, scary for Canon and Nikon, who have not made a great mirrorless camera yet, at least not on the Pro line. I mean, they have had some, but I don't think even the consumer market is really picking up anything that they're putting down. Like, Canon, for example, just said, we're not even going to bother with the M2 in the US. Like, it's not going to sell here.
Yeah, M2 and now M3 as well.
Oh, there's a third one. See, that can
yes, there's
know
a third
it.
One.
I didn't even know
there's
that.
A third. I actually think it's actually quite a great, good camera, and I was actually quite impressed that they did come out with it. But I was wondering why that camera was so clearly, to me, great, evidently great for video, and then crap for photos. But I thought, as a video camera, I think as a video camera, the Canon EOS M1 is a fantastic video.
It is really small, but overall, it's very clear that Nikon and Canon haven't come up with anything that could even remotely rival what Sony and Panasonic and Olympus are making in the mirrorless division.
No, I think where the money is going is everyone who, you know, when you want to upgrade, you're going to upgrade to the next best thing, which is basically, where is innovation happening? And it's right now, it's happening in mirrorless. And I don't think it's ironic that, you know, DSLR sales down 15%, mirrorless sales up 16.5%. So it's basically a little bit more than 15%. And people who maybe still hang on to DSLRs, like, well, let me get a mirrorless as a backup body, or let me add this for video, or, you know, I can still use my lenses on this camera.
Yeah, because of the Metabones thing, like, that's it's huge. And so, in addition to all this, this is big, really big news for Sony. The part that they were, I think, most proud of is they had a 66% boost in the company's mirrorless sales over last year. And this is for a company that was already firmly in number one in terms of sales in the mirrorless division. So they just saw another gigantic boost to everything they're thinking. And I think this is, I can almost 100% guarantee you, this is due to the new Alpha series, the A7, A7 II, A7R, and A7S. They are
which
all...
has taken off like gangbusters, but also they've offered so much different type of a variety in that brand as well, in that brand of A7, which is, you know, first they came out with just the A7, like, all right, full frame mirrors, boom, there you go. And then they're like, well, they also at the same time, you want full frame, high resolution? All right, here you go, with a very loud shutter. Here you go.
A7R.
Yeah, and then they came out with the A7. Well, did you want sensitivity? Because we got that too, but
yeah,
you don't get resolution.
Yeah, sensitivity out of the water on the A7S.
Yeah. Well, there's no
camera.
Other camera that competes with that right now. And before, the other two cameras, I'm sure, the same sensors were in Nikon full frame cameras, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, like Sony's
right, the D800,
the D810, and the A7R, I think, is the exact same sensor.
It is, right, and now there's we have an A7 II part two, which has in body image stabilization, which no full frame camera has ever had ever. Which means that I can use my Leica full frame glass and be able to get image stabilization on full frame, which I could not do anywhere before. And the best thing I could hope for was a 2x crop using it on an Olympus body, which would have been the next best option for me. So that's huge.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, just I lose that Leica look. So there's that.
The Leica look. Anyway, yes. So this is a
big... Hold on. Actually, before you go on, is during the Leica store LA opening, this is like 2 years ago, I actually got to, you know, being a camera geek, I could recognize... these are the engineers that make the cameras, and they're not being mobbed. Like, what? So I went up to him, I talked to him, and I talked to him about, like, well, when can we get, like, image stabilization? And his answer was sensor performance. He's like, in image stabilization basically won't matter if we can get sensor performance up and get and make it more sensitive and better noise reduction, things like that. So you don't have to worry about shooting very slow shutter speeds and getting vibration if you can just increase ISO. Then you have the freedom to choose your shutter speed at will. And I'm like, dang, he's right. damn it. Like, he's totally right. And unfortunately, we're not there yet. But I know that that is... He also said that the mechanism to fit the whole image stabilization will not fit in the M body at that time. And he also told me that there was a gap in the market between the M full-frame camera and their S medium format. And actually, that turned out to be the Leica T, which is fantastic. They did that. But the point is that although we have image stabilization now, which is fantastic for video, which you totally need that for video, something for stills, we can fix that with basically better sensor performance.
And you know, the sensors are getting better, so
yeah,
it's happening. This kind of leads directly into what I wanted to talk about next, which is I tested out something last week that I really have wanted to do for a while, and I got a bunch of people from the industry, both journalists and photographers, to pool votes on what they considered to be the best still cameras on the market right now, modern still cameras. And Karaminder and I were part of that vote. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other members of the resource team, as well as some Adam Otke from F-Stoppers, Mike Wilkinson, who's both on F-Stoppers and with us at Resource, Michael Bonacore, who just joined us on Resource. He's a great photographer. I asked Blair Bunting, who's an advertising photographer. Mm-hmm.
Commercial photographer.
Yes, really, really successful. Casey McAllister, who's based in San Francisco. He's a landscape and adventure photographer, really, really good. David J. Crew from Flurn. We're expanding next time. I'm including another person. I'm including Hansi from SLR Lounge.
Hansi!
Yeah, and a couple others that I'm adding over time. And that's the point here. I'm trying to get more and more people voting in on these to get different results and actually creating a better mean. What I thought was fascinating about this is even halfway through the vote results, I started to see it start to come together. The average of what people were saying, even though everyone's vote number one was different than their and everyone's 10 was different, mm-hmm. It didn't matter. Everything started to crunch down to the center.
And can you talk about your algorithm or how you just averaged out? Is that simple?
My quote unquote algorithm. It's not an algorithm. It's very simple. Basically, I told people to rank their top 10 cameras, and whatever they gave the number one camera to got 10 points. Whatever they gave the 10 camera to got 1 point. And so that's how, and then all the votes for each camera were calculated and pushed together. The goal of this, and I got some questions in the comments, and this was one of our more successful articles that we've had on Resource. One of the questions that I got in there was, like, this sounds more like a staff picks rather than just, like, the best cameras. And I can see where that comes from, but here's why it's not that. One, these people aren't staff. Not everyone that did this is a staff member. And two, this is going to continue to happen every month. And the vote will change, and the way that these cameras are light out will change, and that's where it's more of a rankings. Like, who is maintaining a lead on this industry with their cameras as perceived by people who are using them all the time? And the people that we talk to and the people that we pool converse with their friends, see what their friends, mm-hmm. who are also professional photographers and journalists, what are they using? What are they talking about? What gets them excited? And that affects their vote. And that's what changes and creates this list of cameras you can expect. And it's the same concept when you look at, let's say, college basketball rankings. You can say, like, there's some teams that when the rankings come out, people are like, why is this team ranked above this other one? It's perception and how they're doing at the certain time with certain things against the competition. And that's exactly what this is going to do.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go over the cameras one by one and get your input on them, Karaminder, as well. And we're going to start with number 10.
And okay, start from the bottom. Start from the bottom. Now we're here. Sorry, Drake was on the Apple announcement. It's in my head. Go on.
Okay.
The Apple announcement just finished.
Yeah, WWDC.
We're recording the show.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about it. All right.
Number 10 on this list was the Canon 6D,
you're going to do it. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, the Canon 6D is like the affordable full-frame version of the camera from Canon. Nikon has many, many more options for full-frame than Canon does in terms of like they're across the range. But this is the most affordable full-frame you can get from Canon.
Yes, the most inexpensive full-frame. So it's like you want that full-frame look, but you're on a budget. This is the camera to get. I don't know. It's a workhorse.
This is my favorite time-lapsing camera.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because I'm kind of like, if somebody presented to me where I had to get a 6D, I'd be looking really hard at maybe getting a used 5D Mark II instead.
I would disagree with that. The ISO performance on this is better, and I like the way that it does scenery colors better. I think the 6D saturates better than the 5D Mark II and the 5D Mark III. And I like that. There's a little bit more contrast in the blacks, and the colors are slightly elevated, and I like that.
This is why we do the show, ladies and gentlemen. Important consumer information from the Jaren Schneider.
Yeah.
That's exactly
whatever that's worth.
Jaren, that is the perfect answer as to what my question was, and that's exactly. I probed you a little, but you got that's exactly what I wanted. Thank you so much. All right. Yeah. So, I don't know what else to say about that. I think it's just a budget full frame camera. It's a great camera.
Yeah.
You can make great work with it. I would have no problem making great work with it either.
Yeah. So number 9. This is the only non-full frame mirrorless camera that made the list.
Yes. And I know quite a few people who are actually making great work with this camera.
Yeah. Like Zach Arias like swears by these.
Wait,
Fuji
did we
cameras.
Tell the name of the camera yet? Are we getting ahead of ourselves?
No, I'm building it up. It's the Fuji X-T1.
Yes.
And the entire Fuji line using their X like mount, their whole line I think is really, really quite good.
This is their flagship model. Yeah. Actually before the X Pro 1, which needs to be updated, but right now, this is their flagship model, and I am, Jaren, out of any other camera in the industry, period, this has the best EVF.
I would agree with that statement. It doesn't feel like an EVF.
It's insane, and it's got so much resolution that they're like, you know what? We're just gonna split. We're gonna do picture in picture here. We're gonna give you what you see through the lens on the left side, and then like a magnified area on the right, so you can make sure you get pixel perfect focus if you want.
It's a great camera.
That's fantastic.
The reason I think that it's number 9 on this list is twofold. One, I don't think that many of the people who voted for this use this as their primary camera. For them, I bet this is a secondary or fun camera. And I know that for a fact for at least one of the voters.
Okay.
And then it's also, it's really hard to, like, this is something that Zach Arias has been, a stigma he's been trying to break, but it's really hard to show up on set and be taken seriously when you have a camera, this camera in your hand. It's really hard, and it's stupid. I will say right now, it's dumb. It's dumb that happens.
But perception, we just talked about perception. The whole point of this list is perception, right?
Right.
So perception is 9/10 of the law.
From a professional photographer, from a professional photographer's standpoint, this has its place, but it's really hard to get it like in when you're doing like pro level work and the client is involved. It's rough.
A little tip, guys: get a battery grip. And then add the full size, like, you know, you can get a Yongnuo flash, right? The big full size one. Slap it on the hot shoe, and then with the battery grip and the flash on it, it'll look a bit more impressive.
Yeah.
Just in case you need to do that whole thing, especially if you have like a meeting with your client beforehand, before they decide to even hire you, if they're just checking you out, like you just leave that and you put it on the table and be like, that's there, and then that way that seems immense and confusing and complicated and impressive. Essentially, perception, right? So, all right. Another thing about the X-T1, I know you're saying that some people use it as their like kind of a toy camera. It is. It's still a very, very good camera.
Oh, it totally is. But it's just really small. That's why they use it as their second one that they bring around with them, because they want to tilt the DSLR.
As a side thing, this is the only Fuji. We're gonna. Well, I'll break the news now. This is the only Fujifilm camera on the list. And I am quite looking forward to the X Pro 2. I guess this is what they call it when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it'll be, but this camera made me very excited for that. And what was impressive about this camera before the Sony A7s came out, this had the shortest flange distance of any camera interchangeable ever. And then Sony came out and made it even, and took that crown away. But I think flange distance has a lot to do with also quality of image and their optics.
Mm.
So let's move on. Nikon D750.
That's the number 8 vote. And I think this fell to 8 because of the stigma involved with its quote-unquote light leak issue. When this camera first came out, it had some really bad press with that.
Jaren, can you quickly explain where... I'm not very familiar with the Nikon line, especially these not very well-known ones. Where does this fit? Like, you know, the 60 is the budget full frame. What is this?
This is, I would say, this is a weird one because I don't even know that Nikon is 100% sure where they want it to fit. It's not definitely not up there with the D810. I think it's a step above the 610, the D610. But this also is the only Nikon full frame DSLR that has an articulating screen. And it also
Does that mean it's good for video, Jared? Sorry.
It actually does have pretty good looking video. It does 1080p 60, which it was the first of the DSLRs to do that, and then Canon started releasing theirs that can do it too. But I've shot video with it. The video does look really nice. It's very crisp and clean, but it's still only 1080. So I thought that the pictures that this thing took were worth it. It's really pretty. Like the way that this thing will pick blues and greens is very indicative of the Sony sensors. Nikon cameras do this really well. but I really thought it was really pretty for landscapes. I really enjoyed using the D750.
I don't have much to add to that. Yeah. Just seems to me, in my eyes, my non-DSLR using eyes, it just seems like it's kind of like the Canon 6D, except
it is.
You would say this, the Nikon D750 is better video than the Canon 6D.
Yes. Okay. Immediately, good, yes. To know. And my feelings on this is this camera is exactly on this list where it should be. It should be above the 60, but it should be below the cameras that are coming up. So okay. I feel
but
like
also,
this
real
good.
Quick, back to the Fujifilm. Really crap at video. All the Fujis are. Hopefully they get better. But yeah, all the Fujis, crap at video. Continue.
All right. Number 7, speaking of not of video, this one is not crap at that, but
it's the absolute opposite of
A7S. The Sony A7S is number 7 on our list. And the thing is, we didn't ask anyone to think about video at all when voting for this. So that kind of says a lot about how it reached this height being only 12 megapixels. And that's it. So like it's a full frame, but the ISO performance on this thing is so boss.
It's phenomenal.
That
it's insane.
You can take some really great, I think time-lapsing with this thing at night doing star lapses would be absurd.
Sounds like something that you need to do.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. I use this camera for stills for a little while. I also shot video with it, and the stills, though small, are gorgeous. I mean, they look like they came out of the other larger megapixel cameras from Sony.
Hey, but you were shooting 12 megapixels before, ain't no reason not to now. It just means that you can't really say print as large as you want. But I know there's software out there optimized for that, and I don't know. I think it's
eventually billboards don't actually have very good resolution. No,
billboards are very low resolution, actually. So. You know what, Jaren? You can shoot billboards with your iPhone, which actually Apple already did. We already covered that quite a few weeks ago. So
I mean, if you're going to be out in the dark a lot, there's no reason to not take the A7S. It's got great stills.
You don't need a flash with this camera. No. I mean, if you wanted that look, you could, but you know what's actually really great about this too is when they did come out with this, we said, okay, you can use the full frame look. You can get that full frame look for 4K.
Yeah.
Which, Jaren, do you know of any other camera that can capture a full frame look for 4K video?
No. Right now. I don't think so. But this one still can't do it internally, which is lame. But
yeah, that's the only unfortunate bit is that you can't do it internally, so you have to, you know, hook up the HDMI, hook up an Atomos recorder of some sort, and hit record on that guy, and then you can do it. Yeah. So,
but that said, this list doesn't have anything to do with video. This was they made number 7 for stills, which is impressive.
Still impressive. Still impressive. Now, but these are camera power ratings, Jaren.
Yeah.
Whether it does time lapse, video, stills, makes toast, whatever, it has to be on it. Like this is the camera power ranking. These are tools. This is a tool power ranking.
Yeah.
So whether it does video, stills, better, this, that, whatever, it matters.
The next camera on this list, I thought the video was pretty crummy. But I think that the sensor is probably the prettiest sensor currently available in the full frame is Sony A7R.
Mm. So number this is the high resolution Sony number 7
with
six.
No with a zero anti-aliasing filter, so it will Moir if you're not careful. Moiré. I can never say that word. That and bokeh. I can never. It's too many ways.
So this is how many megapixels again?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I forget. It's
a lot.
24, 18, 24.
It's more. It's 24 or better. And I don't want to look it up right now, but
okay. I think it's we just know this is stupid.
The dynamic range on this thing is actually what I want to focus on because it's so good. You can pull so much out of the shadows with the A7R.
Jaren, real quick, what does it mean? What does dynamic range mean?
It's the ability to across the range of the camera, what you can do to pull shadows and highlights. So if you can pull 5 stops out of highlights and 5 stops out of shadows, you have a dynamic range of 10. As far as I understand it, is that right?
I think you're right because basically, if you shoot a shot and you think, "Oh my God, I'm so underexposed." Actually, go into Lightroom or your photo editing software of choice and pull up the exposure and just be surprised at how much more detail there is in that shadows.
And the preservation of detail without degrading the photo is actually really good in the A7R.
Good. I think a very impressive camera. The only negative thing I would say about this is it's a very loud shutter. So trying to use it in kind of a stealthy mode type of way.
Doesn't work.
Nope, not going to.
That shutter also vibrates too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
because the body is so small, it can't hold up against the power of that shutter. They fixed this in the A7 II. The A7 II is like much bigger of a camera, so it can actually hold up against the shutter. But it's just stuff to think about. If you're shooting landscapes with this, it's not that huge of a deal. Like it's fine. A7R is
great
for it.
Number 5, the game changer to the medium format.
Yeah, the 645Z from Pentax.
645Z.
Now, the reason I don't think this is higher on the list, because anyone who's ever shot with this camera is like agape their jaw with this thing, because it is amazing.
Yes, amazing at $10,000, which is amazingly cheap for a medium format camera.
Yeah, that's high. It's actually eight. It's like $885.
Oh, sorry. Is it eight? It's just for the body, right?
This body only, yeah. Body so only. When you think about that, like, that's actually not that much more than a pro high-end DSLR like the 1DC or the 1DX or the Nikon D4S. Like, those are expensive cameras. For just a couple thousand more, you can get even more sensor. And what was most shocking to me about this camera was the ISO performance was crazy. Like, you could go really high. It felt like I was shooting with an APS-C camera. Like, the what I'm most used to getting out of, like, a 60D or a 7D.
Like 6400 ISO, Jen?
Cake.
Because 3200? Most people probably don't know this. I think most people aren't aware of that. Before, the sensor in this guy is actually a very well-known Sony sensor.
Yes, it is. Same one in the Phase 1. That is
used by Phase 1, used by Hasselblad, and now used by Pentax. And Pentax basically has the lowest price of a camera system around this sensor. And it's a CMOS sensor. Before this, all the Pentax cameras and all medium format cameras and even all medium formats before this were all CCD, charge coupled device sensors, which meant that ISO performance maximum, maybe probably 800.
It looked like balls at 800.
And it looked like balls, yeah. It looked, yeah. And you're probably just, if you're shooting medium format, you're probably already shooting base ISO unless you needed to push it up a stop. But people who shoot medium format are often shooting with strobes and have everything controlled. So it's not a camera that you take out strolling in a walkabout. And the interesting thing is, you can with this one.
Easily. And the fact that
a massive camera. It's like a Canon, but not a Canon camera, but an actual, like, old school from the last century Canon to destroy other people in a war type of Canon.
It feels smaller than a Phase 1. The things that hold this camera back that are the fact that it's the firmware on this thing is a little slow. Like, to pull up images you've taken, the camera has to think really hard. But once you pull up that first image, you can shuffle through all the photos very quickly. So I know it's not the card. It's got to be the camera's ability to think, to bring stuff up.
Yeah, and I'm a medium format shooter, and I have a first generation Leica S2 medium format camera. And it's slow to pull up images, and that was back then. And the second version of the camera, all that it did was add a second chip, the same chip that's in there. We're just going to throw two at it, and it made it better and faster. But another thing about this, Jaren, video, it actually is format camera that shoots video. Unfortunately, it's awful.
It's bad. It's really bad.
But it does it.
It's atrocious. It does it.
Do you know if it takes a full frame or is it a crop of this?
It's a crop. Yeah. It doesn't even do 4K either, but it just looks 4K. Bad. But this is the best, for my opinion, the best. The other thing is to mention, one of the cameras that did get votes was the new Phase 1 XF system, which is a brand new body built around.
Didn't that come out like the day of this power ranking?
Yeah.
Same morning.
It did get votes that day. But the thing is, the XF is we need to use it and actually try it out first. Yes. The fact that it even made the end of the list, which is others receiving notable votes, is good. That it was out for a couple hours and it already made the list. But we'll need to get more information on that and see how it stacks up to
this. But I want to make sure that people know that this Sony sensor and this Pentax, out of the Hasselblad and the Phase 1 camps, they also use the same exact sensor. Pentax is the only one that has video performance or video included in it.
And for some strange reason, they managed to pull more ISO out of it too. I don't know how they did it because it's exactly the same thing. It's just so good. So good. Beyond 32,000 is what I'm saying is you could get out of it and use it.
Okay. Number four, speaking of medium format, we got a competitor, Jaren. You played with this guy.
Yep.
You reviewed it.
I did.
It is the Canon 5DS.
/5DSR.
/5DSR.
We pushed them together into one.
What's the difference between the 5DS and 5DSR? Tell us again, please.
The S has anti-aliasing, the R does not. So it's like the A7, A7R idea.
I wish they would just make up their minds and just...
Yeah, one of them would be better for landscape, one of them would be better for studio work. So the S would be better for our Peter Hurley, and the SR would be better for someone shooting mountains, because you don't have as much of a problem with the Mari. Clothing...
I'm of the sense that trying to fix Mari in software is better than trying to fix it with a blurry filter in front of your sensor, which is what that is, right?
Yeah. Basically, you just described exactly what the anti-aliasing filter does.
Anti-aliasing, all it does is basically put the thinnest layer of Vaseline over your sensor and kind of let's just blur things out instead of making things jaggy. Let's just blur it.
So this camera is good. I don't think that it will replace medium format. It's not there yet. It doesn't have the look, and I found it just didn't shoot it wasn't as responsive as I'm used to Canon being. That's all.
Yeah, and it's 50 megapixels?
Yeah.
So it's insane. So it's,
the photos are enormous, don't get me wrong. But I think it belongs on this list. Number four is higher than I thought it was going to be. We'll see if it stays there based on it. As more people get their hands on it, we'll see. I think the reason it's this high is the idea of it. I think the idea of it was very impressive.
Well, if I were to have a Canon to shoot, if gun to my head, mm-hmm. I had to take a Canon camera, it would be the 5DSR.
I love the color rendition on the 5DS and 5DSR, by the way. It matches closely to what I was getting out of the 6D. It's, I think, better than the 5D, and the video is better than the 5D Mark III.
I might let them pull the trigger and kill me instead.
All right.
I have thought about that.
Simmer down.
All right. Number three is the almost, I guess, industry workhorse.
Yeah.
Canon 5D Mark III.
Everybody has it. Anyone who shoots Canon has this camera.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say about it. Other than
everybody knows what it is. It's on this list. It's old. It doesn't matter. It still works. It works quite well. And I think it will be on this list until the Mark IV comes out, which I'm expecting next year.
Yeah. And then now we're just going to skip straight to number two, which is, I think, to me, a surprising entry. I'm going to say that.
Huge. I mean, I think almost everybody voted for this camera in some way.
Really? So this is the Sony A7 Mark II, which I talked about earlier as the only full-frame camera with in-body image stabilization, yeah. A.K.A. IBIS.
Yeah, you're the only one who says
AKA
that.
A.K.A. IBIS. I say IBIS, IBIS.
The body on this thing, as mentioned previously, is thicker. It's a little bit beefier. Which
I think it's a bit. It's a good thing for ergonomics that it's bigger, okay? Let's just get that out of the way.
I have small hands, and the A7 I and the A7R both, and the A7S, they all feel small in my hands, and I've got small hands. So anyone who's got like larger hands is going to be like babying this thing. They also changed some of the button layouts and put them at angles, so it's easier for your finger to actually push them.
They actually have one like where the... like a trigger kind of a style button where the shutter is, which is better.
Yeah. So this is a really good camera. And
it's a good evolution of the A7 body, which is the first time we've seen it in.
And the fact that it's number two, and the fact that we just finished talking about how DSLRs are on decline and mirrorless are coming up, this is a good example of that, where pros are basically saying, respect Sony's A7 II.
Yeah. And Jaren, what's the video opinion on this? Because
I don't know. I've never shot video on it. I talked to Michael Bonacore, who owns it. He has never really shot much video because we're GH4 guys, so it's tough because we don't use this for that. We're going to shoot 4K, and so
I've heard, or my feelings from the vibe of the industry is that it's not panned, it's not hated, it's just,
it's okay.
So yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, it's a still camera. It's a good still camera. Really good.
And
still camera.
Finally, number one, we've already talked about this. It's the sensor we've actually already talked about in another camera.
I'm pretty sure you could guess at this point. Like, well, what's left? What could we possibly have? A D810, Nikon D810.
And by the way, it's the megapixel count, 36.3, same as that A7R2. Oh, it's okay.
A7R2?
A7R.
A7R.
Yeah, there's not two yet. Yeah, so A7R. Okay. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay, so the D810.
There's like 15 Sonys on this list, and you mean we're only doing 10? It's only 10. There's a lot of Sonys on this list.
So this is basically everyone's favorite camera right now. If you're a Nikon shooter, you have an 800 or an 810. If you're a Canon shooter, you sort of often are a little envious of the quality that you'll see other Nikon shooters getting out of their D800s and the D810. The only downside with this camera is that the actual file size, it gets kind of beefy to work with these. If you're shooting events or weddings with this, you're going to fill up cards and fill up hard drives fast. This thing takes up a lot of room. When this camera first came out, that was like a major complaint. Be like, oh my God, this takes up so much processing power to get through these images. But
first world problems.
Yeah, that is a good problem to have, in my opinion, is if your camera is just really, really good. I think the D810, it will be Nikon's flagship for the next maybe year. I expect probably a new iteration of this.
Well, hold on. I think I wouldn't let you use the word flagship because I think their flagship is what, D4S?
It's not. And it's not. I can tell you right now, Nikon wants you to be using their Nikon D810. Yes.
Okay.
Without a shred of a doubt. Now, the D4S is a great camera, and that did receive votes here, by the way. But the D810 is where they're all in on that, and I think they should be. This is a really, really good camera.
Yeah. All right. And that's it. Video performance on this is great.
Good.
Quite unlike the Sony A7R, which video is not very good and uses the same sensor.
Yeah. Again, I don't really think you should be shooting video with many of the cameras on this list. The only one I would say, yeah, go ahead and do it, would be on the A7S.
A7S. Yep.
Yeah. These other ones are just like meh. There's a lot.
But it's good to know.
Options.
Look, if you can have a tool that does both really well,
yeah,
you would want that.
Pat and Lee like swear by their Nikons and shoots video with them. patently from F-stoppers.
Yeah, so the, you know what, a great tool, Jaren, that does great photos and does video?
I'm going to guess you're going to say the iPhone. Yeah, there it is.
The iPhone.
So the thing is, that did also get votes in the power rankings, so it's not out of the question. It's there. But no one, it's not taken with the same, like when someone asks what camera should they buy, the answer is not responded, oh, you should go buy an iPhone.
So. But is that what this is for? It's meant for
That was one of the reasons. I think I wanted a place to point to tell people, like, here's what people are using. Make your own judgments about what you should get based on what the what professionals are using. If you want to shoot how a professional shoots, here's what they're using.
And I always think, you know, it's always good to maybe get inspiration. But if you found your own way of, let's say, using, I know of a wedding photographer. She uses medium format film to do her weddings.
So I know. I wonder if we're talking about the same one.
We are talking about the same person.
Yeah, she's really
lovely
good.
Lady.
Yeah, Lauren Jonas.
Lauren Jonas. And so if you can make your, say, little niche carved out of a unique tool that only you use, like, hell, I use a Leica. I'm not ashamed to say that. And that's how I do it. But, you know, there's something to be said basically just to not be a copycat. But there is something to be said about this where this is these are the industry standard tools.
Yeah, and this was just to get a finger on the pulse is what this is for. To keep, you know, what's up there? What are people talking about? What are people using? So.
Right. Speaking of what's up there.
Yeah,
see that? See what I did there? We had a good buddy on episode. I don't remember the number.
I think it was a single number, a single digit. It was in the before 10.
Our buddy Mike Kelly from LA, he actually has a Kickstarter project where it's about his LA airspace photos, and he's turning that into a lovely coffee table book.
And we want to give a shout out to Mike because, one, Mike's awesome, and two, I personally think that Mike's photos of LA are my favorite photos anyone has ever taken from the air. I really, really like his eye, and I like how he sees the city and the subject matter he chooses to shoot. And he does things at various focal lengths while he's up there. So he'll do like a really zoomed in shot of like a parking lot from directly above. So all you get is the lines, and he'll do a wide shot of the city with like the, I guess it's smog, but clouds or whatever, with the sun filtering through it, hitting that city. Yeah, and he actually makes LA, a city that I despise, he makes LA look great.
I was going to say that too. Like LA, like I understand LA's significance and importance, but when I'm in LA, I'm like, oh, I'm in LA.
I just can't wait to get out.
Yeah, and it's a bit rough, but you know what? And Mike is shooting this all in black and white. And I know there's lots of, you know, you can, I think he would have an easier time.
Well, he shoots it in color, but he edits it to black and white. But he's done others too. He's done them not in black and white, but his best ones are in black and white.
Oh, I totally agree. That was going to be a point. Is his eye from being an excellent architectural photographer and lending it to these, you know, in the sky landscapes, if you will. These are fantastic images. And I have friends who are from LA that live up in the Bay who are, obviously they miss LA. They love LA. I mean, Randy Newman, I love LA, right? So that's a song, Jaren. I don't know if you know
I'm
that.
Just going to let that go.
But people who are from LA love LA. I have one. I don't really talk about it too much, but I do shoot some, what do you call it, landscapes from time to time. And I don't think I'm actually any good. This is why I don't talk about it. But people love my LA one. I'm like, really? Okay. But I think it's more because they love LA, not necessarily my work, to be honest.
So if you love LA and you're from LA, and you're interested in when you know in the city, I think you should definitely take a look at what he's made.
Yeah. You can get a signed print.
Yeah. I mean, the pictures themselves make me feel like LA could be a place to live, and I hate LA. So if you love LA, this is totally going to speak right to your heart.
These are gorgeous, gorgeous pictures about the real LA.
Yeah. And it was a Kickstarter, like a staff pick, too.
Yeah. So, congratulations to Mike. It was a staff pick picked yesterday.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
And he is now 29 days left to go as of recording. Mm-hmm. Little less than, or a little bit more than a third on his way to his goal. But hopefully he meets his goal and he is able to publish this lovely, how big is this? How big is a book?
It's a big book. It's a coffee table book. Not like a little novel. It's not
9x12. Okay. 120 pages.
Basically, I was killing time right there over the audio to get you to find it on that page.
Thank you. Right.
All right.
And I'm deeply saddened that nobody has really taken advantage of the $2,000 pledge where he gets a helicopter, where you get a helicopter ride over Los Angeles with Mike, lunch or dinner at a local restaurant of your choice. So choose wisely. And you get the book and one 36-inch print of your choice.
You know,
as well as more stuff.
This brings up an excellent question because this is clearly an art book.
Is the question, does Mike put out? Sorry, go on.
God. The question is photography art? And this question was asked of some Sky News reporters and broadcasters or whatever. And I'm going to play this for you.
Yeah, famous TV personalities from England.
From England. I don't know any of them, but I'm going to play this the audio for you because all you need is the audio. You don't need to see their faces or anything. Just listen to what they have to say.
Photography, secret passion of mine. Yeah, I've been completely abusing my situation over the last 10 years and taking lots of pictures of bands and things.
As it has become the egalitarian expression of society and community, it's a symbol of friendship, sharing. It's such a vigorous changing place now. There's none of that sense that only someone who really knows what they're doing can take a good picture.
I love photographs, but I have to say, I don't understand why some are better than others.
Photography is the easiest of the arts, so I like that about it. It's like the ukulele of the arts world. Anyone can do it. I really am not very admiring of photographers. I think basically you just have to know someone in East London and then you can become a major photographer.
I wouldn't go to a photographic exhibition. Although I did go to one recently. Now, whose was it? Bailey's, David Bailey's. And that was amazing. And his photographs were superb.
Yeah, I found it difficult for a long time to think of photography as an art. So all photographers are now throwing things at the television screen. I'm sorry, but I did. I thought, and I think that's partly a sort of inverted snobbery, because we could all take photographs, therefore what was special about it? It took me a long time to work out what was special about it.
Working with a young photographer who would kind of sit there and kind of go, one more roll, just one more roll, just one more. And you think, hold on, you've just done 30 bloody rolls. And what you know that they're doing is they're hoping that out of the 1,000 bits of crap that they've thrown at the wall, one is gonna land. On the other hand, people like Terry O'Neill, who's taken my picture a few times, spend a lot of time setting up and go, click, and that would be it. David Bailey was the same. Click, click, click. Okay, let's talk about girls.
So if you're like me, you're not feeling particularly...
Or like me too, Jane.
Yeah, Jesus.
Don't. It's not just you.
If you're like us, if you're like Kara Minder,
so deeply offended,
and me, you leave that with a really bad taste in your mouth. And I think that mentality right there is why it is so challenging to get paid what we deserve to be paid for work. Like people who are not educated in the system and what it takes, like that right there is a perfect example of why none of us get paid in some circumstances. Why we always have that one client that you can remember that just really, really underappreciated you.
Now, I think Jaren, these are all subjects. Like, these are TV personalities, so they're used to being in front of a lens, video camera mostly, and then finally when they go to stills, they always say, I don't even remember going to a photography exhibition. Wait a second, yeah, I did, and it was quite good.
And it was great, but she, at the same time, is, like, downplaying it. Oh, God,
right.
Makes me so angry. Like, and the thing is, I understand where they're coming from, but we talked about this before the show, and there's a really good example of how I want to say that it isn't this way. When people, you equated it to, like, cooking. And like,
I did. I said it's, I think photography, just because you have like a camera in your pocket with your, let's say, iPhone, it's accessible to everyone. But so is cooking.
Yeah.
But yet we do recognize paying for very good food by a very good chef.
Yeah.
And celebrity chefs at that too.
Right. There's a ceiling and that you can see through this. It's the glass ceiling. I'll go ahead and use that, even though it's not really the glass ceiling. It's a glass ceiling.
Tell me more.
A lot of people hit this ceiling that they can't go past. Like, everyone can be good at cooking. I think everyone has the potential to be good at cooking, but not everyone can be great at cooking. And that goes the same way with photography. Everyone can be good, but at a certain point, one of those women says something perfect, and she says, "I don't know the difference between a good and a great photo, or a bad and a good photo. I don't know what makes up the difference there." And that's, I think, the core of the problem here, is they don't know. They have no idea what it takes to make an image. They are only sitting there watching a photographer do the shoot. And the one guy who says he sees someone taking hundreds of photos and hoping they can get one good one out of it, that's just someone who's watching a photographer who enjoys not missing a moment. It's a totally different situation from the guy who set up all the lights and took his portrait than it is for someone who's out there shooting a bunch of pictures of a continually changing situation. And Cameron,
did they get lucky?
As a headshot photographer, are you not firing constantly as well as Peter Hurley? You both fire a lot.
And yeah, a lot of that is because we are trying to capture micro-expressions. I mean, we're getting into a very finite thing, but yeah, we're trying to capture micro-expressions, which are fleeting at best. They're just, you know, not even 10th of a second.
And you can never get them to repeat that face if you tried.
No, that's right. And so it's not just it, but I'm not spraying or praying. I'm watching them and I'm timing it and I'm getting it just right because, you know, one is I know my equipment so well as I know when I hit it to trigger, and I'm also directing the client and I'm really wrangling them. And in the most kind and gentle way possible, of course. But I am pulling out the best from them and trying to time it right with getting the right shot. And sometimes their face may do something weird, but hey, that's what we get paid for. I'm consistent. I can pull that out. That's what a professional is. That's what a professional does.
And that's why I think it's just like this totally lack of understanding of why that what we do. What's baffling to me is that the lack of understanding of like chefs is the same way. Like people have no idea what they're doing or how they're doing it, and yet they can get away and are treated with this respect and we're not. And I think it's because we're not all carrying around a frying pan in our pocket. We are all carrying around a camera in our pocket.
Well, technically your phone could get hot enough.
Yeah, right. Good.
All right. But listen, Jaren, I do feel that like maybe I always think when you get bad feedback or you think it's bad feedback or feedback that doesn't fit what you're doing, take a look at the person giving the feedback. And so in this regard, it is a video interview of TV personalities. These people do not pay for photography, right? It's the publishers that do. And so I would think they have a higher value and higher respect for that form, basically the people hiring us, than say the subject, which is who these people are. These people are more accustomed to being subjects in front of a camera, not paying for photography.
I hope you're right. I hope that this is not the common view of everyday person. I really hope
I think the only time people like that would need a photographer is they want to document an occasion, aka wedding photographer.
Yeah. Which I want to bet that they're going to be baffled at how expensive a wedding photographer is and like, why would I have to pay that much?
But they did mention a lovely UK photographer named David Bailey quite a few times. His name came up quite a bit of just like, well, they're like, well, he's really cool. He just set up everything and I came in and took one shot and then we talked about girls for the rest of the day. You know, they just did that. Just a unique approach and different approach, but every photographer has their own approach of doing it. But he's an example of where they thought that was an exception. And I think maybe that is probably the photographer that connects with them most and that they're most relaxed and they probably get the best shots as well.
Still, for that. I think the overall message makes me angry, so I'm going to move on.
Let's move on to something inspiring then, Jaren. Let's not be so depressed. Jeremy Cowart.
Let's talk about one of my favorite photographers as a human being.
One of my favorite photographers. One of my favorite human beings.
Yeah. Jeremy Cowart is pretty awesome.
Jeremy Cowart put out this free PDF called Absorb.
Yeah. I'm looking at it right now as we're talking about it. I have it in front of me.
Oh, so am I.
I downloaded it. And essentially, I think what this is really, really good for is to humanize a successful photographer. It's really easy to get to think that these certain photographers that you see out there are the ones that are like the really high profile ones, such as Jeremy Cowart. It's easy to get lost in thinking that they're this superstardom, but this book actually shows that Jeremy Cowart is influenced by a lot of other people around you. He may share influences with you, and the questions and the way that he sees these people tell you that he's still growing, he's still learning, and he wants to know more and become even better. He's not really any different than you or me. That's what this is really great about. And that on top of, you could actually see what makes these photographers tick. He asks them specific questions about what they do and why they do it and their outlooks on stuff. And then it's just it's good. So if you're feeling down about where you are and how you are seeing things and people, and you want to get out of it, I think this is a really good way to show that you aren't very different from an extremely successful guy.
Yeah. And this whole PDF is, I would call it a public service. It's I don't know, akin to something of like even Catfish. The whole, you know, Catfish TV show, I believe, is also a public service where people get educated as to what could be out there. And this PDF I see as that as well, as a public service of, you know, it's things you can read it and see. He's asking all his people that he looks up to what inspires them, what keeps them going, and they answer. Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's fantastic.
It's called Absorb, and it's because, in Jeremy's words, I absorb it all, and it makes me who I am. So keep that in mind, and you continue to be that sponge that Jeremy is. So.
Yes, Vincent Lafore is also in this as well.
Yeah, Jeremy L. or Joey L. Sorry,
Joey L. Joey L. is in this as well. Lara Jade.
Yeah. So there's a lot of photographers that you probably follow that yep. Jeremy follows too.
Zach and Jody, Kyle Chowning.
All right, so we're going to wrap up this episode with a question that we actually
Peter
got
Hurley.
From
I
a
should
listener.
Mention that. Peter's in there too. I have to mention that.
Listener Daniel Mateus, he's a concert and event photographer, sent us a bunch of questions, and we're going to go over a few of them over the next few episodes. The one that we're going to cover today is he specifically asked us how we got into this industry at all. Like, how did we get here, and how we currently got to sitting here doing a podcast about this sort of thing? And for me, that's I have to go way back.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to have Karaminder go first. Karaminder.
Oh, dude, okay.
So how did you get started in photography?
Okay, so I went to school for design, and it was for new media. And I remember when you have to make your portfolio website, and I'm designing things like, you know, business cards, letterheads, identity systems, packaging, whatever you design anything like that, you can't just take a screenshot and put it on your website. It doesn't look good. It looks chintzy. Looks juvenile. Looks, I don't know, not pro, whatever the opposite of that, amateur hour. And so what you have to do is you print it out, you mock it up, and then you take a picture of it. I was not very good at taking pictures. I didn't understand. Even though we were required to take a photography class, I didn't really remember anything out of it, really. And so I wanted to get better. And at the time, I had a 20D. I used to run an online wine business selling wine. And so I had went to Costco, bought what I thought was a good camera then, and then I kind of just sat on it with an 18 to 55 kit lens. I never understood why I could make good pictures with it. So I had that for a couple of years. And then finally, when it came to like, all right, I got to take real good pictures, and I did some research on the internet, I found all these people talking about prime lenses. I'm like, whoa, what's a prime lens? And I kept Googling for it. Like, I didn't understand. What does that mean, prime? Is it? I just go and find, and I went to Amazon, typed in prime lens, and like nothing came up. Like, I don't understand. Like, people tell me to buy prime lens, and I don't, like, it's the word prime lens, and I don't understand. And then finally, I think I want to say it was Gizmodo put up a post about, I don't remember exactly, but this is the prime lens you should buy or something like that. And it was the Canon Nifty 50 or the Thrifty 50, if you want to call it. Basically, it's $100 50mm f1.8 lens. And I didn't understand anything, focal length or f-stop. I didn't understand anything. I just knew this is a prime lens and it costs $100. That doesn't seem so bad. I can swing $100. But to me, $100 is a lot of money still. But if it meant that I could take better pictures, okay, I'll do it. So I got that. And then, like, holy crap, I discovered depth of field. And 20D is a crop sensor camera and using an 18-55 lens. I just remember I never made any good photos with it. Never made a single good photo with that kit lens. Didn't understand anything. But finally, you having a prime lens, which if you don't know what a prime lens is, like I didn't know, a prime lens basically means a lens that does not zoom. That I wish somebody could have just told me that. It would have saved me so much time, so much agony. But, you know, I know all these people who want to buy a camera, they're all like, yeah, which zoom lens should I buy? Which zoom lens? Like, don't buy a zoom lens. Anyone that comes to me who says like what they should buy is, first of all, do not buy a zoom lens. It will ruin you. Just buy, and I used to recommend a 50mm equivalent focal length. Now I kind of recommend a 35, but people on a crop sensor, I say just buy a 35mm lens or even the Nifty 50, fine, because it's cheaper. But that's what I recommend to get, and just live with that. And they're like, well, how do you zoom in? And I go, with your feet. That's what you got to do. You just got to walk
manual
closer.
Zoom.
Yeah, manual zoom. That's how you zoom in. But I said, just trust me. You want to be good. This is how you do it. And that's kind of how my journey started. Was I started taking better photos of my, like, because I had depth of field, I had something to play with, but it was still about a 75mm equivalent. But that's how I learned. And I used to volunteer in like local temple groups, church groups, temple groups, and take pictures that way. And they kept asking me to come back to take pictures. So I figured I'm having fun here. Let me keep trying. Let me keep going. And I remember I took another workshop and all these people had Leicas, and I was like, this is cool. I hated the size of my DSLR, so got rid of that, sold all that. And I didn't go to Leica. I went to mirrorless. I sold it because the 20D was too huge, and I bought a mirrorless camera. I bought a GF1, and that, a GF1 with like a 20mm lens. I have it here. I sold it, and then I bought it back again, different, not the same exact camera, because I was like, this is part of my history. I love it. And it's a good camera still. To this day, and I can still take it out, still use it. And that is kind of how I began. That's where I learned photography. That's where I learned to change my f-stops and shutter speeds and all that. The Panasonic GF1, small micro four thirds camera. That was excellent. I know there's more, but essentially that's how I got started.
The part two of this is actually the second part of his question is how we started actually doing business wise. So that'll be next week.
We're not going to cover that now.
No. So that's your story on how you actually got into photography.
Jaren, how did you get into this? What were you educated in, and continue from there?
I am a marketing and business major. So
I'm going to call you Suit now. I just watched Entourage this week. I'm going to call you Suit.
My major is business administration with a concentration in marketing and entrepreneurial leadership. I got that at Gonzaga University. And while I was there, I had this Fuji little point and shoot camera, really old, super thick. I think my family still has it. I kind of stole it from my mother when I went to college because I knew she wasn't gonna take any pictures because I'm not around. She wanted to take pictures of me, so I just like, can I take this? I'm gonna take it. I took it out. I remember what drawer it was in, and I was always the one who went and grabbed it. So I just took it and just went to college with it, and I just took pictures with it, stupid pictures. Like I was just playing with. For me at the time, I didn't understand anything about like what you were saying, focal length. I didn't understand prime. I didn't know f-stops or anything, but I did know composition. What I did with the point and shoot was I composed images. I'd like, this looks like a pretty thing to me, and I would focus on that. I took a class for fun I had a Jesuit who was running my particular dormitory when I was a freshman. His name is Father Reynolds. He was a photographer. And he liked to talk to me about it because I was interested in it. I just didn't really know anything. I took a class he decided he was going to start, and it was on film. And I'm like, I could do that, but I don't have a film camera. And then I remember that my dad does. My dad has a Nikon FTN, really, really old film camera. I actually have the lenses. I still use his lenses to this day because they're great. But I borrowed his. It had a broken light meter. So I couldn't use the in-camera light meter. I had to actually zone. So I learned zone and then promptly forgot it later and did a bunch of film developing. I played with it, but I still didn't really understand focal length and f-stops. Like I got the concept, but from an artistic perspective, I didn't really know what they did and the impact they had on images. But for me, it was still just a hobby and I wasn't going to do anything with it. I tried to get a job in Spokane, Washington, which is where Gonzaga was, and I didn't. I did not get the job that I thought I was going to get.
What kind of job was that?
Going to work for Zach Designs. And Zach Designs, ZAK, exclamation point, they make like plastics and toys and like plates and stuff for kids. So, like Disney will hire Zach to make their cars plates. Okay. It's like, you know, for kids to enjoy eating off of, that sort of thing. And they make cups and toys and all that kind of stuff. I did not get that job. A friend of mine got it instead, and at the time I was devastated. I thought that was where I was going. I was going to be a business major. I was going to manage stuff. Nope. So I came home, and I started looking for work here in California, and my first job was at a company called Photoflex. They hired me while I was on my way.
I've heard this story before.
They hired me while I was on my way back to Spokane to go to Star Wars in concert, which I had tickets to at the time. And I was on the car on the way there, and I said, sure, I'll do it. And I said, I'll be there next week. I'm just going to be gone for the weekend. I worked at Photoflex for 2 years. And during that time, I learned from three photographers who worked there exactly what I was doing, what happened. They taught me everything about light, strobes, all that stuff. And I basically got a free apprenticeship. I got everything I needed to know about cameras and that sort of thing from them. And those are the photographers are Jeffrey J. Lunn, Ben Clay, and another guy, just David. I called him Dave. And they taught me everything that I needed to know. And it kind of branched off from there. And when I left F-Stoppers, when I left Photoflex, I joined F-Stoppers. And I worked at F-Stoppers for 3.5 years. And now I'm kind of moved over to here. So I kind
of... Who's here?
Resource Magazine.
That's right.
So
who'd you bring with you?
You. You came.
And?
Michael Bonacor.
And?
Mike Wilkinson.
Yes. I think that's
so you have it. But anyway, that's kind of my history of how I actually learned photography. And I still recommend it to this day. Apprentice. Find a way to apprentice. If you really want to get into it, find someone who's doing a good job at it and learn from them. And it's easy enough for me to say because I got paid to do something else and I was able to apprentice for free. But you could probably do it as if you started earlier than me, maybe do it in college. You could probably, you know, afford to do it for free and learn. And the other person that I know successfully did this is Lee Morris of F-Stoppers. He also apprenticed.
Yeah, I actually have a friend who is learning. He's a video guy. He's in the same city as me. And he's learning still photography portraits from me. And he just basically kind of assists me and asks me questions. And I just tell him the stream of consciousness from my brain, like how I do things. And that's kind of actually how I do my teaching anyways. Like, well, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm seeing. And yeah,
I also forgot
for Leica Academy, which is my shirt that I'm wearing. So I'm a Leica Academy instructor too.
I forgot to mention one thing. People probably don't know what Photoflex is. They make lighting and strobe equipment and reflectors.
That's right.
They don't exist anymore. They went out of business last year.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, actually, not last year. But there you go. Anyway, that's my story. That's Karaminder's story. Next week, we'll talk about how we specifically got into our niches and how we did that.
Yeah.
So that'll be next week.
Niches, not snitches.
So thank you. Thank you so much for asking us that question. We really appreciate it.
Thank
we
you,
want
Daniel.
More questions like that. So Daniel, we're going to work our way through this very long email you sent us and try and answer everything you got in here. But that's part one, and we will hit you up for the rest of these later. So thank you again, Daniel, and we'll keep going next week. So
yeah. So, I'll finish it off, Jared.
All right. Close
it out. And guys, thank you for joining us again for episode 16. Comments and questions, just like Daniel gave to us, you can reach us on Twitter at Rewrap Podcast. Jaren's also on Twitter at Jaren Schneider. I'm on Twitter at Karaminder.
You can email us at rewrap at resourcemagonline.com. That's how you can send us a real long question.
Yep. Rate us on iTunes, please, because we need the love. And, this has been the Rewrap Podcast, and we'll see you here next week.
Thanks for joining us, guys.